Okay, let's get started. I hope we have the sheets from last week.
I have an extra one if anybody wants, because I went and printed it today.
Ah, okay. So Marilyn has an extra for anybody who needs. Excellent. Okay, now we're talking. The session for today is the fourth in our four-part series. Whether we're actually going to get to do anything significant on our fourth topic, we'll have to see, because we still have to do our third topic. I apologize for not being able to extend, but it's just not an option for me. We started last week with the topic of modern forgeries, or as I explained last week, these aren't really forgeries. The term I used was pseudepigraphy, in which you write something and claim that somebody else wrote it. That's the idea. And certainly true for the first of the two that we're looking at, this case of what I call the Besamim Rosh. That's the name of the book. And we gave background on it already last week, talked about the Haskalah, the secular enlightenment that had existed, that had influenced an enlightenment in the Jewish world. And the move of the Enlightenment was for secular learning, involvement in broader society, general liberalization, although not the same, as we said last week, as reform. And after introducing that, I introduced Rabbeinu Asher, also known as Rush, who was a leading Jewish figure, the end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th century. He started out in Germany and was a leader in the Ashkenazic community before persecution in Germany led him to flee for Spain in the beginning of the 14th century, and he became a leader in the Sephardic community. And we talked about the major role that he played in influencing Jewish law because of his own work on the Talmud, writing a commentary which dealt specifically with issues of Jewish law from the Talmud, and then also his son being the Tur, author of a revolutionary code of Jewish law that would come out would come out obviously later, the next generation. But the point is that the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, is a giant within the development of Jewish law. And so if you want to write a book that is going to put forth the sort of liberal positions of the Haskalah, and you want it to be accepted, one way you might do that is by claiming that your book was actually written by Rabbeinu Asher, by the Rush, who was prolific, who wrote many, many responsa. We have hundreds of his responsa. So that's what happened. Somebody publishes a work called Besamim Rosh, which, as I mentioned last week, is a reference to sweet-smelling spices. He publishes it in 1793. It has 392 responsa. The publisher is, or the person who brings it to press anyway, is Rabbi Shaul, son of Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Berlin. His father was the head of the rabbinical court in Berlin. He claimed, Rabbi Shaul Berlin, claimed that he had found this work, compiled or put together by a rabbi in Italy. He didn't have access to the original manuscript. He only had a copy that was made from the original manuscript, which was in a library somewhere. And so he puts out this work. Sorry.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow, it is. He puts out this work, and accusations of fraud soon follow. The work itself was very solid. As a work of responsa, claiming that it dated back to the beginning of the 14th century, it's actually very solid. There's a certain style that is found in the Jewish legal writings of that time, and particularly the ones that were in Sephardic lands where Rabbeinu Asher ended up living. There's poetry. There's a very poetic style, by which I don't just mean rhymes, but in terms of interweaving lines from Midrash and verses and there's a meter to it and there's a beauty to it. That's actually in there, along with the style also of writing sometimes very brief responsa. In later periods, as the centuries go by, a style grows of writing very lengthy responsa in which you discuss and debate all sorts of sources before finally getting to your conclusion at the end. But in the earlier times, you had responsa that were very brief. There would be a paragraph. It would be, yeah, I think this is the answer, and that would be that. Not always, but they were certainly more prevalent in earlier times. And he's careful to imitate the style of this earlier time in the work. So he brings this work to light, and the fact that you have a printing press helps, as it is now spread very quickly before it can be debunked, even though there's opposition very early on. Before it can be debunked, the work has already spread. Well, what causes people to not trust this work? A few things. First of all, the Shaul Berlin, who I mentioned as the one who brought this book to light, was himself known as an early maskil. A maskil was somebody who was into the Haskalah, a supporter of this enlightenment. Maskil literally is somebody who is enlightened. So maskilim is the plural, if you've heard the word. Heard the word? No? Okay. So Shaul Berlin himself had a reputation as being something of an agitator within the Haskalah. There were, at this time, all sorts of, you know, writings and counter-writings that went back and forth, and he had been involved in writing an attack on a Rabbi Raphael of Altona and his work of Jewish law. So he was already somebody who was known. You have somebody who's known as an agitator for the Haskalah who suddenly comes out and says, hey, this is cool, I found a 500-year-old work of Jewish law. You sort of question a little bit, you know, why is he the one putting this out? That's number one. Number two, because some of the opinions that are presented in the work among these 392 responsa don't have any sources presented at all. He simply says, I think this is so. And that's not a style you're going to find in writings of Jewish law. It's always about the sources and the precedent and what I can build on. It's not you don't find writers saying, well, I just think this is so. But most of all, quite a few of the opinions he presented seemed very unlikely. And if you take a look at your sheet, you'll see what I mean. In source number 4 on last week's sheet, this is from the authentic responsa of Rabbeinu Asher, of the Rush, and it presents his view of philosophy. He writes, "The wisdom of philosophy and the wisdom of Torah and its laws do not follow the same path. The wisdom of Torah is a tradition received by Moses from Sinai, and the scholar will analyze it via the methods assigned for its analysis." We have special methods for analyzing text, comparing one matter and another. "Even where this does not match natural wisdom," meaning even if my conclusions from Torah run counter to what general thinking says or what science says, we follow the tradition. Philosophical wisdom is natural, with great scholars who established natural arguments. And in their great wisdom, they dug deeper and corrupted and needed to deny the Torah of Moses, for the Torah is entirely unnatural and revelatory. His point is that as philosophy goes, you use human logic, and you use your observations, and you draw conclusions. And he says that isn't going to square necessarily with something that is taught by revelation at Sinai, with a tradition that is passed down. And he says, if I have to choose between the two, I'm going with revelation. I'm going with that which has been passed down by tradition, not someone's philosophical insight. Now, that's a good subject for a lot of discussion. We could have a whole mini-series on that and classic Jewish approaches to philosophy. You had figures like Rabbi Moses Maimonides, Rambam, who was heavily into philosophy. And then you had those who pointed out, you know, the only thing you can trust philosophers to do is to disagree with each other. That's the nature of things. Because realistically, even if you're starting from the same set of data, people come to different conclusions because their thought process is different. So why should I trust this philosopher in particular when now, or in 10 years, or in 50 years, someone else is going to come along and reject everything he said, which, frankly, historically has worked out. Meaning, at the time that he is writing this, at the time that Rabbeinu Asher is writing this in the early 13th century, people are still putting Aristotle on a pedestal. Yeah, and having discussions about proving that the universe has always existed. ideas which, you know, in our day, you look at and say, really? People, like smart people, believe that? But that's what philosophy does. Philosophy doesn't necessarily have all the evidence to work with. It works with the evidence it has and draws conclusions. So his argument is, that's fine, let the philosophers do that, but that's not what I accept. That's Rabbeinu Asher's position. And he goes on here. I'm going to abbreviate just because I do want to get to some of our fourth topic. But you can see the text here yourself. He is not a fan of philosophy. Well, having said that, take a look at two responses that show up in Besamim Rosh, which is, again, attributed to Rabbeinu Asher. Source number 6 is a discussion about a scroll that had been written by somebody, a scroll presenting philosophical ideas. It's in source, I'm sorry, not source number 6, source number 5. He says, one who opens his mouth with doubts in various areas, somebody who voices skepticism about Jewish tradition, should not be judged heretical. With our own eyes, we have seen giants of Israel speak harsh things occasionally, things one may not hear. Some of them are even recorded in books. Benevolent God will atone for him. One is not termed heretical unless he attacks our tradition. So in this response, he's taking a softer approach to somebody who questions Jewish tradition. And again, I'm bringing you only a small piece here, but it's out of a piece about a scroll that was written that proposed all sorts of philosophical ideas. And what he's claiming is that it's really not the end of the world. Unless he comes in and says, I don't believe in this whole thing, it's not heretical. But it doesn't square with who Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, was. In another response, and that was the one that I thought I had brought on here, but I see I didn't. In another response, he writes about the importance of Jews studying Greek philosophy. How it's a very good idea, in order to be able to address philosophical issues, we should study their works. Now, there were those who said that. Rabbeinu Asher was not one of them. He said, stay away. So when someone who is known as an active member of the Enlightenment says, I have found a 500-year-old work by somebody who could be safely described as anti that movement. But in this work, he supports what I'm doing and what I'm saying. You sort of question, you know, is this really authentic? You know, you sort of wonder. And there are other positions that are like that. I brought you some of the responsa here. He has one in which he's lenient about shaving with a razor, which was and remains. There's a biblical prohibition against shaving parts of one's face with certain parts of one's face with a razor. But he hasn't been lenient. If you go to a non-Jewish barber, then he can do it. All sorts of ideas that are in here. He has one response, and I think I did bring it. If you take a look at source number 7, I did bring this one. God gave the Jews the Torah to bring them to satisfaction and completion, to goodness and pleasure. Therefore, occasionally when we have sinned in our ways and warped our paths, some of the Torah's laws have damaged the good which should have come upon us via fulfillment of the Torah, and then we have rejected that law and done the opposite. As the pious king said, King David, he means, it is a time to act for God. They have nullified your Torah. He says, Torah is really meant to make things good for us. Over time, whether because of our sins or historical events, yeah, some of the laws of the Torah become difficult. And they make it hard for us to see any pleasure out of the Torah. So at that point, it's time to say, okay, let's drop it. And he continues on the next side. If it could be imagined that a time might come when the laws and mitzvot of the Torah might clearly bring evil upon our nation, the whole nation, or even if it could be imagined, they would not bring satisfaction to the nation, then we would throw its yoke from upon our necks. The hinge upon which all of the Torah's laws turn is that God instructed the Jews to perform these laws out of love, for he desires kindness, he spoke good for Israel. So what he's saying is that Rabbeinu Asher, the stalwart of tradition, said, only so far as it goes.
Those cheaters.
Well, yes. So not everything in his work is leniencies. He's really trying to make it authentic, and you have to put a lot of time into this. I mean, this is somebody with clear-cut time on his hands. I don't know where in the world he got his support from, that he could just, you know, devote his life to this. But in the end, What sealed the deal was when one of his friends had a copy of another anonymous work he had written. He made a living, apparently, doing this, publishing anonymous works. So one of his friends had a copy of one of these works, and he wrote a note in the margin saying, this was written by Shaul Berlin, author of Besamim Rosh. So, you know, you have to make sure not only do you not sign your name, but others should not sign your name as well. That's important. The answer is he had blabbed to somebody, clearly. Interestingly, though, this is a case of a forgery which wouldn't die, in the sense that it has been reprinted repeatedly. This original one was 1793. It was reprinted in 1881 in a sanitized version, in which there were things that were taken out that were particularly controversial, and again in 1984. There are still people to this day who argue that maybe there's a core of it that was legitimate and authentic, and he just threw things in. It's a remarkable thing. Stephen, you were going to say?
So it was not a copy.
No, no, this is fake. That's my understanding. Yeah, I mean, he wrote responsa. Rabbeinu Asher wrote, as I said, we have hundreds and hundreds of responsa from him. But this appears to just be, you know, somebody else being creative in order to push an ideological agenda. But it isn't always about ideology, and so I wanted to mention a second case. This is kind of a head-scratcher in terms of what led him to do this. We've said before that you have, after the Torah is given at Sinai, or along with the Torah given at Sinai, we have this verbal tradition that is passed on. The verbal tradition is anchored in what is called Midrash, in which the text, the biblical text, has various anomalies, whether it's letters that don't seem to fit, there seem to be anomalous spellings of words, or whether it's sometimes extra verbiage in a text, things that are out of place. And Midrash takes those textual anomalies and says, well, they're meant to teach us things. And laws, as well as ethical instruction, emerge from those nuances of text, and that's what makes Midrash. We talked about already how that's passed down through the generations, and ultimately laws are written down in the outline in the Mishnah during Roman times in the 3rd century. And then you have commentary on that and the discussions that are going on in the study hall. And those are written down in what's called Gemara. Mishnah plus Gemara are Talmud. And we mentioned that there were two Talmuds. There's the Babylonian Talmud, which is written in Babylon under the Persians. And then there is the Jerusalem Talmud, as it's called, written in Tzipori, which is right near the Kinneret. I recommend going to see the digs. What they've dug up is incredible. They have all sorts of mosaic in the synagogue floor. But also, just in general, what they've managed to resurrect in terms of the life of the people who were there 1,800 years ago, who were writing all of this down. They were the ones who wrote down the Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud is written under under Roman rule. Both of the Talmuds are based on the same text of the Mishnah. And in source number 8 on your sheet, I listed for you what are called the orders, or in Hebrew, Siddarim, of the Mishnah. Meaning the sections of the Mishnah. The first one is called Zra'im in Hebrew. That's about agriculture. Primarily related, obviously, to the land of Israel and the laws of tithing Israeli produce, the sabbatical year. There are elements of it, though, that also are relevant even beyond Israel. Things like challah, separating off some of the dough when one makes bread, it's supposed to be to give to the Kohen, to the priest. You know, these days it's burned in the absence of a temple. But that's Zra'im, that's agriculture. The second one is Moed. It deals with the Jewish calendar. It starts with Shabbat. It deals with all of the various holidays. It deals with the fast days, various calendar-related rules. Then you have Nashim, which deals with marriage and divorce. Nashim literally means women. So it has the laws of marriage and divorce. Then you have Nizikin, which is tort law, damages, and the civil law, the judicial system, the set of courts. All of this is there in Nizikin. Then there's Kodshim, which is about the temple offerings, as well as laws of kosher slaughter are in there as well. And then Taharot. And Taharot deals with ritual purity and impurity. So a Babylonian Talmud today consists of the Mishnah that is found in these sections, but by and large, there is no Gemara on the first order, the agriculture one. Only on one volume within Ezraim is there Babylonian Talmud, as well as the last two, but Taharot, there really is not, except for, again, one volume of Taharot has Gemara also, but the rest of it does not. Why? Because the Babylonian Talmud is written post-temple for Jews, not for Jews, but by Jews who are living in Babylon, who are not dealing with the agricultural issues, separating tithing. They don't have Israeli produce. And they're not dealing with the purity and impurity issues of the temple either. Mind you, those laws do come up in the rest of the Talmud that is there, because the discussions that are going on one topic weave their way through all sorts of other topics. So they do find their way in. It's not as though you're seeing a Talmud that doesn't deal with agriculture and that doesn't deal with purity, but it's interwoven into other discussions. Nothing is devoted explicitly to it. Whereas in the Jerusalem Talmud, you do find a full commentary, a full Gemara on the issues of agriculture that are in the first volume. But what we're getting to here is the fifth out of the six orders. The fifth one, Kudshim, temple offerings. Historically, there was a Jerusalem Talmud on these temple offerings. Maimonides alludes to it. If you take a look at source number 9, Maimonides, in his introduction to the Mishnah, writes, "And so did the sages of Israel," meaning they did as Rav Ashi did, compiling the Jerusalem Talmud. The immediately preceding line in Maimonides is when he's talking about how the Babylonian Talmud was compiled. And he says the same thing happened for the sages of Israel compiling the Jerusalem Talmud. The compiler was Rabbi Yochanan. We have five complete orders from the Jerusalem Talmud, but the order of Taharot does not have Talmud at all in the Babylonian or Jerusalem Talmud other than the volume of Nida alone. But he says you have five, just not Taharot, the last one. And the problem is that even as Maimonides, writing 800 plus years ago, says we have five, if you were to go to a Jewish bookstore or library today and look at an edition of the Jerusalem Talmud, you would only find four orders. You won't find five. The one on Kudshim, the one on temple offerings, isn't there. At some point in the last 800 years, and we can narrow it down further actually, but at some point in the last 800 years, that disappeared. How did it disappear? Well, we already learned about one easy way. Right? The destruction of all of those manuscripts. Considering that, in general, Babylonian Talmud was studied far more than the Jerusalem Talmud, for several different reasons. One being that the Babylonian Talmud was written later, and they had access to the ideas in the Jerusalem Talmud, so where they disagreed, the assumption was, well, you saw the earlier argument and you decided otherwise, you must have had a good reason to. So that makes it more authoritative, they have access to the earlier information. That's one reason. There are several reasons that are beyond the scope of the discussion right now. But bottom line is, people were not studying the Jerusalem Talmud the way they were studying the Babylonian one. Manuscripts would not have been copied over and spread the way the Babylonian one was, which means that when the church is burning wagon loads of Talmud, whether the one in 1240 or whether the one in 1553, these events, plus the general censorship that goes on, contribute to the destruction of the Jerusalem Talmud. We're lucky that four orders remain, but the fifth one, the one on temple sacrifice, we just don't have. However, that didn't stop somebody from claiming that he had it. In the year 1907, sorry?
It's amazing that the Dead Sea Scrolls are fine. Written to over 2,000 years ago, fragments at least, but then they can't find any evidence other than Maimonides saying that there was.
Oh, there are others besides Maimonides who mention it. He's not the only one who mentions that it existed.
To this day, no authentic.
No authentic manuscripts, that's correct, for the Jerusalem Talmud. That doesn't mean it won't come up somewhere, in the same way that 120 years ago in the Cairo Geniza, they found all sorts of documents that we only knew by attribution in other texts, but now we actually have them. So it's possible that it will come to light at some point. you know, keep in mind, the Dead Sea Scrolls are discovered because they're sitting in jugs in a cave. That's the best place to keep it from the censors. But that's, you know, realistically, it takes someone going into the cave. The Geniza in the synagogue in Cairo was being, yeah, maintained is not really the right word. It wasn't maintained. There's a good book that describes the state of the Cairo Geniza before it was found. It's called Sacred Trash. Is the title of the book. And really, like, everything was just dumped in this room. It was a massive floor-to-ceiling room with a wall in front of it, and there's a little hole up in, towards the top of the wall. And people who had documents just threw them in there. Whether they needed to go, Geniza was supposed to be for documents you weren't allowed to treat disrespectfully. So if it had God's name on it, if it was a passage of Torah, then you're supposed to put it into Geniza and it's stored away. And ultimately what's done with those works usually is that they're taken out and buried. That's usually what happens. But there, they were just, for centuries, literally centuries, just piling them up in the room and no one's ever cleaning it out. It's a remarkable story. But but in any case, going back to the point here, it's possible that at some point in a Geniza somewhere, pages of the Jerusalem Talmud on Kachem will be found. It's certainly possible.
What happened to it eventually?
To what? Oh, the Cairo Geniza? So what happened was collectors were getting documents that had been taken out and putting them on the market. And so eventually they ended up with Solomon Schechter. There were two nuns who also who were involved with this somehow. Two sisters. Yeah.
I
want to
read a book, Guide to the Perplexed, by Deborah Horn.
Okay. Sacred Trash was a pretty good account also. But the bottom line is that it was because these collectors or sellers to collectors were putting them on the market. Entrepreneurs. Right. Capitalism rules, right? That was how these texts came to light, and then they're still being cataloged. There's actually, out of Toronto, the Friedberg family sponsors something called the Friedberg Geniza Project, which digitally scans and catalogs the texts that are in the Cairo Geniza, so you can get them online. So, in the year 1907, I don't know if he's a rabbi or not, someone claiming to be a Sephardic rabbi comes to Hungary, saying, I have the manuscript of the Jerusalem Talmud on Kachim, and I would like to publish it. His name is Shlomo Yehuda Algazi Friedlander. The Algazi part, I think, is more credible as Sephardic than the Friedlander piece. But Shlomo Yehuda Algazi Friedlander. He claimed to speak only Hebrew and not Yiddish, right? Because, you know, Sephardic rabbi speaking Yiddish would be a little bit unusual. He claimed that his brother, a businessman, had come across it in Turkey, that he had gotten it from a Portuguese converso, right, a Jew who had been passing as Christian to survive the Inquisition, who had himself received it from a priest. He produced with this glowing haskamot, letters of approbation, right? We've talked about haskamot as letters that either say all rights reserved to this author and no one else should copy it, and we talked about them as letters saying this has already been censored and therefore this thing is okay for publication. This is a haskama, is a letter of approval. He has letters from rabbis who say that this is legit. Solomon Schechter actually was very into this. He supported it. So when Algazi Friedlander comes to Hungary, he goes to the head of a yeshiva there and he says, I would like your letter of approbation. Here are the letters I've already received. Here's some of the manuscript. You know, I would like you to give me a letter. The goal ultimately being, if I get enough letters of approbation, I'll be able to get this published. That's the idea. Well, the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva there, looks at it and he says, no, your manuscript is not accurate. I'm not going to do it. So that doesn't stop him because, of course, we live in a world of self-publishing, right? He did not have the means that we have. Nonetheless, he is able to get a couple of volumes published with his own commentary on it. Now, if you ever look at a page of the Babylonian Talmud, the way that it's the standard way that it's published is that you have the text of the Talmud in the middle, And then, for the last several centuries, the way it's been published was that on the inside margin you had a commentary by Rashi, explaining text line by line, and then the outer margin you have a commentary called Tosafot, which literally means additions, things that are added, which is an accumulation of comments by the generation of Rashi's grandchildren, and them plus another generation later, in which they'll look at a Talmudic text and say, well, this text says this, but there's another text somewhere else in the Talmud that says that, then we need to try to either justify it or conclude there's a debate. And that's the way that Babylonian Talmud is, generally speaking, published. So he publishes parts of his Jerusalem Talmud in the same way, with his own commentary on the inside as well as on the outside the same way, with the and two different styles of commentary. He continues his travels. He travels to Romania. He meets somebody by the name of Yekutiel Yehuda Greenwald, who is a student in yeshiva. And he asks him to help him speak in the synagogues there to promote his manuscript. Greenwald says, well, what are you going to speak that people are going to understand here? By this time, actually, their travels continue, and he's now in Germany. So he says, how are you going to speak to the crowds in Hebrew in Germany? Then the people who are into Talmudic scholarship aren't speaking Hebrew. So he says, that's okay, I've learned German. I've learned German, so I can speak German. So Greenwald is a little bit surprised, especially because the dialect of German that he's speaking is apparently similar to Lithuanian Yiddish. Lithuanian Yiddish, yeah. Nonetheless, he says, okay. Greenwald ultimately separates from Friedlander and goes to Satmar back in Hungary to learn. And sure enough, eventually he encounters Algazi Friedlander there. He becomes Algazi Friedlander's secretary to write his letters for him. And in the course of doing that, he learns that Algazi Friedlander is actually Austrian. That Algazi is not his given name. And that Algazi has actually written, Algazi, Friedlander, has actually written, not under his own name, some of the letters of tribute that he's showing people for this Yerushalmi. He also learns that Algazi Friedlander has written to the Maskilim of Hungary for support as well, because by the time you hit the early 20th century, the Haskalah has moved east and is in Eastern Europe as well. He's written to them for support, and that he has shown them different sort of parody and satire texts that he's written, including a satire of the Zohar, a work of mysticism that he believes are going to appeal to the Haskalah. Well, he did a really good work. He did a really good job with this Jerusalem Talmud, enough so that none other than Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, also known as Chafetz Chaim, also known as author of the Mishnah Berurah, a critical work of Jewish law that is very popular, actually bought into it, believed that this was legitimate. There's a classic debate regarding tefillin. Okay, tefillin phylacteries that are worn on the head and on the arm. So there's a debate about the order of the Torah portions that are found inside of it. Because there are four paragraphs from the Torah that are inside of the tefillin, in the arm one and in the head one. Two of them come from last week's Torah portion of Bo. Two of them come from the book of Devarim, of Deuteronomy. Those are the four places in the Torah where we are told to write this down and wear it. So that's why those are the ones that are in the tefillin. But there's a debate. Do you put them into the tefillin in the order they appear in the Torah, or in a slightly different order? The classic view that most people use is the position of Rashi, and that is, it's in the same order as it appears in the Torah. But there's another view which was held by Rashi's grandson, Rabbeinu Tam. So that, actually among Lubavitchers, they will have two pair of tefillin. They'll wear the first pair for the beginning of Shacharit in the morning, and then they'll take off the first pair and they'll put on the second. There are those who actually will wear two pairs simultaneously, and that can work, but that's rare. But you'll have some people who will have two pairs of tefillin. I'll tell you a great story. Actually, I apologize for taking your time with it, but it's a great story. The story involves a friend of mine. My family is close with a sofer, a scribe, in Jerusalem, whose name is Ezra. Ezra Daifani is his name. But it's a great name for a sofa, right? He used to be in the Cardo, and then he moved. He was in the Moriah bookstore in the old city, and now he moved again. He's near a place called Keshet. But in any case, very, very bright man. So I just heard this story last week, the week before, about him from somebody else who also knows him. He had cousins who were not observant, and they had a pair of tefillin that had come down in the family, and they wanted to use it. So he said to them, you know, you should get it checked. And he took them to Ezra to have the tefillin checked. Ezra takes a look at the tefillin, looks at the young man, and says to him, you have a twin brother. What? Yeah, you have a twin brother. He had not said anything about having a twin brother. He said, not only that, you have a twin brother, and your parents are not observant, but your grandfather was very observant. This is like spooky. Like, what are you talking about?
Like a medium.
Yeah, but it wasn't. What it was the tefillin that he showed Ezra. Ezra looks at it and he says, oh, those are Rabbeinu Tam. Those are the Rabbeinu Tam type of tefillin. That's because he opens it up and he sees inside the order of the parchment. So he sees that it's Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. So he says, look, no one has just Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. The dominant view is that the Rashi tefillin are the right ones. And Rabbeinu Tam, possibly. So that means that whoever originally had these tefillin had two pair. Why did this kid only have one? The answer is that it's because the grandfather had two. He was very observant that he had two pair of tefillin, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. The son in between, the father of this kid, was not observant, didn't know any better. He has the two boys. He gave one of them the Rashi. Why did he want to give Rabbeinu Tam one? So Ezra figured it out. That's a great story. Yeah, he was right. He was right. Yeah, I love that story. So anyway, that's not the point in any of it. The point is that in this Jerusalem Talmud, that this the forgery that was created, it claimed that Rabbeinu Tam was correct. I mean, Talmud is before Rabbeinu Tam, is 1,000 years before Rabbeinu Tam, but it put forth the view that Rabbeinu Tam would later take. You follow? So that led the Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, to actually start wearing the tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam, because it's now in this Jerusalem Talmud. He believed that it was right. Now, parenthetically and very interestingly, so we don't have time to read source number 10, but you can see it there. It actually was shown, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef showed, that in the Jerusalem Talmud, which some sages had as late as the 13th century, they actually did have an edition of Kachim, this missing volume, and it included this idea that tefillin is correct. So in other words, it's not without basis that what Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, the Chafetz Chaim, did actually had a basis in the authentic one, the one that was around in the 13th century, separate from what this fellow wrote much later. However, opposition mounts to this text, insisting that it is indeed a forgery, and various great figures of the day come out against it. Rabbi Meir Simcha Cohen of Dvinsk, also known as Meshe Chachma, the Rogachover Gaon also of Dvinsk, the Gera Rebbe, various figures come out. There's a reward that's offered for the original manuscript. Can you come up with the original that you say this came from? But of course, nothing is there. Friedlander claims that his brother, who was responsible for acquiring the manuscript, has now died, and therefore he won't be able to do it. The nail in the coffin is a revelation that comes out in a journal that Al-Ghazi Friedlander had been prosecuted in rabbinical court years before for writing false amulets, claiming that they cure people and so forth, and that he had admitted his guilt. What he had apparently done, this is remarkable, what he did in order to create this document, what he did was, there's a Talmudic commentary called Yifei Einayim, literally means of beautiful eyes, which consists simply of citations. If you look in the back of a traditional volume of the Talmud, you find all sorts of little mini commentaries that have been written over the last several hundred years. So one of them is this Yifei Einayim, and all he does is there's a Talmudic discussion. He'll quote like two or three words of the discussion, and then he'll tell you where you can find parallel discussions in Midrash as well as in the Jerusalem Talmud. So he takes this Yefei Einayim and sees there are references to existing discussions that were in the Jerusalem Talmud, and he creates parallels to those discussions.
He fabricates it.
He's retrofitting, so to speak. He just changes some names and some details to create Jerusalem Talmud discussions that are parallel to the ones that Yefei Einayim is noting are in the Babylonian one. He goes through Maimonides as well as other early authorities in Jewish law, and he identifies laws there that don't seem to have a source in the Babylonian Talmud, so he gives them a source in his Jerusalem Talmud. He put an incredible amount of work into this thing.
Like a Google search.
Like what this guy could have done if he would have been honest.
Instead of evil.
Well, that's the question. That's why I said this one leaves you scratching your head, like, why? What was the point? So maybe it was to make money. Like, he thought this would get published and he'll make it rich.
Ego?
Like, I put one over on the world. I don't know. It's bizarre. But that was his story. So that's a wrap up of number three. But this is really something out of this world remarkable. Okay, that brings us to our last topic.